Hi, and welcome to my podcast series, The New Abnormal. I'm Sean P. Lodeshenesy from Brand Positive, a research, foresight, and strategy consultancy for corporates, agencies, and NGOs. I've spent 20 years working on catalytic projects around the world, and along the way have been lucky enough to have met some amazing people, from psychologists to activists to creatives, some of whom are guests in this series, along with an array of other fascinating individuals. I'm also the author of The Post-Truth Business, which focused on trust, while my second book, Influencers and Revolutionaries, focused on innovation. My next book will focus on foresight. So, I hope you enjoy this podcast, which is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, a global leader in applying futures thinking to solve strategic challenges within organisations. But now, let me introduce today's guest. So today I'm really pleased to be joined by Diego Gilardini, the leadership advisor and speaker about the future, communication and culture. He helps leaders and companies turn uncertainty into possibilities, helping leaders navigate uncertainty by achieving clarity through a future-proof vision. His background is 20 years as a journalist, of which 5 were spent in Washington as an international affairs analyst. He was then based out of China for many years. He wrote the excellent book Decoding China. The main mission that drives Diego as a leadership advisor and futurist is providing strategic counsel to the C-suite at the intersection of global business, corporate foresight, communication and culture. We'll talk about all of that and more. But Diego, hi, and how are you?
Hi, Sean. Glad to be back, actually, because it's not the first time that we are on a podcast together. So it's I'm good, thank you, and really happy to be here.
No, thank you. I know it's fascinating. It's been very interesting over the years, having sort of spoken with you and listened to your viewpoints on what's going on and what's facing us, or certainly some of the issues that are facing us. Now, in terms of where we are today, in two very interesting locations. So you're in sunny Lisbon. What a fantastic place. I'm in Brighton over in England. So go on then, Diego. So how are things generally with you?
Well, things are generally very well with me. And sometimes I feel like I was having a coffee in a very nice and cozy square in Lisbon, surrounded by trees. And it was like the day after the whole big mess with Wagner in Russia happened, right? Like,
wow. What a contrast.
And so, yeah, and then you see what's going on in France. And so it's just like, feel that you're really privileged, and that helps you go like through these crazy times. Because I think that, I mean, if you look at from an historical perspective, what's going on now, it's quite scary. And so we have to be aware, at least when we are privileged to have like a good life in these crazy times. And then on a professional level, also it's been very good. And in terms of like trying new projects, facing new challenges, and with the idea that, yes, it's we had a conversation before with you, and it's incredible, like, how many things really changed just in a couple of years, or they didn't change, actually. I remember that we had like a very interesting conversation during COVID, I think. And the real question today is that, did we really learn something about that big crisis, right? Big question mark. Yeah. And for me, is if you want, like, to sum up on a professional and personal level, looking at what's going on, the more you know, the more you read, the more you go deep, the less you know, actually, which is exactly the opposite of what's going on now, actually. When people, the less they know, the more they scream, and they yell their supposed truth with the truth with the big T. And this is so frustrating, annoying, and it's really something that gets me so mad, to see the level of stupidity that we are surrounded by. like sometimes, you know what I mean?
yeah, totally. I mean, it's interesting going back to, and I know you're sort of a great sort of thinker and all the rest of it, but as I say, the famous Socrates quote of the only thing I know for certain is I know nothing for certain. I mean, you mentioned that point about one of the sort of previous conversations we had way back at the start of COVID, and I think one of the things that came out at very early in COVID in terms of a really dynamic viewpoint on it was put out by Thierry Malory and Klaus Schwab at the World Economic Forum, who at that point were talking all about the Great Reset, which really seemed to grab a lot of the sort of public attention at the time. I think recently, and I know you've also been writing and lecturing about this, the term of the year, I think so far, or certainly the term that came out of Davos this year, was the polycrisis.
Yes.
So before we sort of step back and go through your really interesting career, perhaps just talk a bit about that, to jump in at the deep end. So, you know, when you're talking to your clients and at events about the polycrisis, about the lay of the land and what you see around you and how to try and navigate it, you know, how long have you got? Perhaps just to talk a bit about that.
Well, but you know, like I find, by the way, the term of the polycrisis very interesting, and it's I think it was included in the WEF Global Risk Report in January, and it became part of the global conversation. But it was actually, if I'm not mistaken, the one who actually invented the world in the 70s was the French thinker of complexity, Edgar Morin. Who was one of the first thinkers, you know, like talking about climate risk like 50 years ago, right? And the complexity of the world. So is the world more complex than it was like 50 years ago? You know, also the other title that was used, I think, in one of the WEF documents, it was like the future is not what it used to be. Right.
Yeah.
And what I think that every era, every epoch has this feeling about the future, right? If I think that when the future is the problem with our times, said Paul Valéry, the French philosopher and writer, either before or after the World War One, so over a century ago, is that like the problem with our times is that the future is not what it used to be.
Yeah.
So, what is really new today, I think there is definitely something new, is that the speed of change, and then definitely what's the polycrisis, is the fact that we are not just one crisis, but like simultaneous crisis on different level, and then the combination, the impact of all of them is much higher than just the combination of each element, right? So it's a holistic... Yeah. It's a holistic crisis that requires a holistic mindset to tackle it. So to answer your question is, I don't think the clients, because I had recently, it was, I think, in January or end of last year, I actually used the polycrisis framework idea in a speech about the future for like an international bank. You know, was invited to talk about geopolitical risk and perspective, but potential future developments within, you know, the context of that bank presenting to their top clients and partners the 2023 investment choices, right? So I remember talking with the guys there and said, like, obviously, we don't want you to tell us what would be like the best investment decision we can make. I mean, I have no authority in that field, but please help us just bring a little bit of more clarity, you know, and that, I think, what many people, and it would be like many smart people in the sense that they want to understand, right? And you know very well better than me that we have a lot of smart and open-minded people in the corporate world, but also people who are not, right? Mm. So when you are lucky enough to meet people who are, they don't ask you to provide certainty. Mm. They are smart enough to know that you cannot, because that would be like a lie, right? So and the fact that the real opposite of uncertainty is clarity, not certainty. So trying at least to provide some clarity within the chaos, right? Like about the different threats on the geopolitical, technological level, but trying to put them, you know, in a clearer picture to help people then make their own decision, but without giving answer, actually, it's actually providing better questions, right? And help people understand that the more they want to get certainty, the more likely they will get bad surprises, right? So it's actually embracing uncertainty really means like being being open to the uncertain. And I mean, within uncertainty, you have obviously a lot of risk, but also you have opportunities. So if you embrace uncertainty, you obviously embrace the risk of, you know, of getting some bad surprises, but you might also be able to find opportunities that others don't. So I find myself in a very interesting intellectual position when I'm working with these clients, because so you don't have to provide answers. And actually what is very interesting is that when they ask you very difficult questions about what's going on, for example, about China, you know, I lived in China a few years. Yeah, I wrote a book, but I mean, it's so many things have changed since then. I mean, less than a decade, but still. I get annoyed when people still ask me, you know, as an expert of China, I'm not a China expert. After what happened in the last few years, I mean, I got so wrong on so many levels, like most Western commentators and analysts, you know, like we were. You know, I still remember when we thought that Xi Jinping would be like opening a new era of Chinese kind of liberalism because of his personal history. Yeah. Right? And if you want, we can go back to that later. But anyway,
yeah.
So when people ask me, you know, what do you think about China? And I said, man, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know what is their goal, if they have any. And then I try to provide some context, right? But I step away from the tricky part of giving an easy answer just to make like the person in, you know, in the audience happy, and actually happens to me a couple of times, well, in last few months, to tell them, I'm sorry, I'm not able to give you an answer because of this and this, because it's too complex. And actually people, after coming to you and thank you for your honesty, it must be such a... you know, such a rare thing to happen in many corporate situations where you have like this consultant coming with pre-packed models that they apply regardless of the context, and then when there is like tricky question, they pretend to get an answer, but people feel that it's not genuine, that there is no honesty, right? And so it was very revealing for me that on the one hand, they thank you for your honesty when you're not able to provide a straightforward answer. And then they thank you finalizing my answer to your original question. I'm not getting lost on work. It's about like thanking you for helping them think better.
Mm.
You know?
Yep. Yeah,
you know better than me. Many leaders and executives don't have the time to think strategically about the future. Unfortunately, sometimes just to simply think because they are caught up by daily urgencies. And so, but maybe some are lazy, but some really don't have the time to be able to think in a more abstract way and making sense of the complexity of a world. And so. Sometimes taking, you know, that couple of hours of a strategic workshop in a nice hotel when you can really forget for a while about, you know, the office and the urgency of the present, you can see how as a facilitator, as a speaker, it really helps them just get out what they have, because they can think about the future. They can imagine things going in a different way. They just usually don't have the time or the context to be able to do it. And when you help them just create that context and the intellectual field, if you want to be able to and they're super happy. And this is like really the feedback that they get of the time. And it's really, you know, you do similar job. It's an incredible gratification, huh? When someone tells you thank you for helping us think better. I mean, there is nothing better. It's not providing answers that can be, you know, wrong. It's just help people gain clarity in this mess of the poly crisis. So it's, then obviously you're not all clients like this, right? But when you're lucky to miss this kind of clients, you can be optimistic about things, you know, really changing. I mean, it's because people with, it's plenty of people with good ideas, but sometimes the context of the companies doesn't help them to actually promote these ideas and turn them into reality, right?
Yep, absolutely. Now, that issue around it, also think you're alluding to there about hope and optimism, and also the ever-present, you know, vital need to link that with skepticism as well. I think it's absolutely fascinating. Also, just one of the points also, just go back to, just again, to give added context to this, is your background and how things got going. Because I know that, again, a lot of the writing you put out there, sort of, you know, the issue of sort of curiosity seems to always come through. Perhaps back to sort of the top of the conversation and actually how you got to where you are now. Perhaps just talk us a bit through that about, I know it all sort of started in sort of Southeast Asia, I believe. So perhaps, yeah, talk about the either the very straight or, as I say, the very windy road that then led to help you to do what you now do.
Well, it was definitely not like a straight line starting. I don't know, when you are in high school, you want to become a doctor, then you make your studies, you become a doctor, and you go on and become a successful doctor, right? If I think now, not even like 30 years or 20 years ago, what were my ideas? Like, if I think about 5-6 years ago, I wouldn't know a lot of the things I'm doing now. There's also like, maybe I'm... we're not actually being really conscious or strategic about it. I have been embracing uncertainty in my own life, and when I try to make sense of finding like a common thread among the different things that I have done and that I've been doing, yes, I think it's curiosity, right? And I think like the first way for me to quench this thirst for curiosity about the world, about ideas, you know, I grew up, I mean, I think it comes also in part like from family. I grew up surrounded by books, you know. Yep. It's like a lot of books, and not saying that I read them all, far from that, but just being surrounded by books, by the love of culture, by like parents, right, taught me how important it is to open-minded and curious. I think it was somehow like wired into having this innate curiosity about what was going on in the world. You know, apparently when I was a child, I mean, really a child, I wanted to watch the news, even if I didn't really understand. But you know, I wanted to, you know, so I think I always had that. And then like sometimes just like some chance in lives leads you to take a specific path. And a little bit, it was like that for me, eventually getting into journalism, and it was a great experience because I come from Switzerland. It's a small country, and one of the advantages of like of a small country is that when you work as a journalist, especially for like the public broadcasting, you can have, or at least that's how it was. No, in my time, if you could be young, but you could have incredible professional experiences that, like, in bigger countries, like, imagine the UK, like, in the BBC, only, like, a senior journalist would have, like, some term of, like, being, you know. So I was really lucky. Obviously, I also, like, had, like, good mentors, and I had, like, really, really interesting experience and adventurous experience around the world, and I really started seeing the world in a different light, you know, like when you but what was interesting for me is that when I ended up in situations that were like pretty critical, right? There was a little bit of tension. Well, the immediate reaction, if you want, like in an instinctive reaction, it was about excitement and curiosity. You know, so I never got into danger. I think I was lucky, but I remember that even the first time that I traveled just privately, you know, like as a tourist on my own, right? It was I don't remember, it was in my 20s. I don't remember exactly when, but it was a long solo trip through Southeast Asia, and I remember that feeling when I landed, I don't remember where, but like in a Southeast Asian city, where, you know, like I had this feeling of being lost in translation, like, you know, where am I, like suspended in some kind of weird, you know, surreal situation. And actually, I remember that I really enjoyed that feeling. And I don't know why, but it made me feel free. And not scared. And I think that was a moment, maybe I realized only later, was a moment when I really understood that I had to pursue professional choices that would lead me to see the world in a way or the other. And then, yes, journalism was the first way to do that. And like my last experience as a journalist, because then, you know, you've been doing for many years and you think you did enough and you want something new. And that's why, you know, I moved on to something different. But, you know, I had this chance as a last stint, if you want, to live 5 years in the US and in a very different historical time than today. It was between the end of the Bush administration and the presidential election of 2008, amazing experience, you know, like getting to know this very complex country by following the different candidates throughout different states. It was an amazing 5 years experience, both on a professional and a personal level. But then, you know, you feel the need to do something else. And I mean, obviously we don't have like the time to go through all that happened in my head in those times, but yeah, you need to change. And back then I was getting curious about China, what was going on. I had friends who had lived there. So, you know, okay, there must be something interesting there. And then so leap of faith, moved to China, trying like to learn the language, learning a little bit. And I mean, today I'm completely forgot about it, right? But it was... And then again, accident of life, chances, you meet people who give you the opportunity to work on that. I had to completely reinvent myself, like working more in a business setting, helping like companies doing business in China. And it was really tough also, you know, like it was, you know, to learn. But definitely one of the, long story short, the biggest lesson I drew from that experience is that definitely culture was a key in understanding why things would or wouldn't work, you know, on a business level, also many different levels, you know. And because for me, again, it was during like over 4 years, in many cases I felt that kind of, you know, lost in translation feeling that I mentioned earlier. And yeah, it wasn't always easy. Actually, most of the time it was tough, but you learn a lot, and you realize why then people can get things wrong about each other so easily in the world, like you know, it's just because we are so different and we don't make the effort to try to bridge that difference, or at least having, you know, the curiosity and the open mind to try to understand the others better. And I, obviously it's much easier not to do it, because when you have to do it and they try to do it in China, it's tough. I mean, this is another world, literally, you know, like I remember I had to work a lot, obviously, subconsciously on my own identity, right? Because when I as a child coming from Switzerland, you know, like with multicultural country, you would identify, if you want, like a Swiss Italian, a Swiss French, or a Swiss German, and then you start like traveling and see that the world is much bigger than that, and you see the beauty of Europe, like the differences that makes Europe such an amazing country. And then we can get back to that later, because I'm a big defender of the European idea and the European cultures. And then I got to the US, and I remember that I was so annoyed at the beginning when there were like some Americans telling me, like in that typical excited and enthusiastic mood, like, "Oh my God, you are so European." And I said, "What? You know, like, what are you talking about? Like, I mean, Europe goes from Oslo to Palermo. I mean, you have like, what does it even mean?"
Yeah, yeah.
But then experiencing my life as a European in the US, actually, when I was working a lot with other different European colleagues, whether like Spanish, Dutch, whatever, regardless of the big differences that we could have, if you take like the European perspectives, living in the US, we had so many things in common in terms of what we did like and what we did not like about the US. So for the first time, I really felt that it was actually good. So when they were telling me you're so European, it wasn't just their perspective. It was actually somehow true. And then I moved to China and I became overnight a Westerner, because even like the American guy from Texas, whom you don't necessarily share a lot with in China, is more similar to you than to a Chinese and the other way around. So it was very interesting to see you know, how, and that's also makes you understand why then it's so easy to use categories to make sense of what's going on, right? Because they help you put order into, and I actually think that this is, I mean, it's very understandable, the process behind the need to put categories and try, you know, to label you, but it's the end of creativity and of progress. Actually, it's when you try actually to ride the messy waves, you know, among cultures, disciplines, to try to get contaminated, right, by different ideas, by different contexts. Sooner or later, this will come up. And for me, if I think about what I'm doing now, like, why am I able now to work on like complexity, future thinking, strategic thinking with companies, is that because it's also a combination of what I have done in the last few years that have been ruminating within me, and now it comes out. I am able, definitely more able now than I could have been, I don't know, 10 years ago, to connect the dots, because I've been struggling among these dots directly, you know, not just on the books. You know, when you end up like discussing with some state-owned enterprise manager in the middle of nowhere in China, it's, you have seen it, right? And so it's everything is coming to fruition now, if you want, right? Of this combination of experiences, even journalism. I mean, what I learned in those years today, it's still so important when it comes, you know, to communicate, to understand within like complex reality, like the essential information, how to turn them into an effective message, and also how just simply to ask questions.
Yep.
Which is maybe the most important thing. I mean, it's your job, actually, also like a business anthropologist, if you know, like asking the right question is much more important. And I realized that when you have this coupled with a genuine curiosity, you know, I don't have to do it. It's like today makes me laugh, like part of the BS industry that we have today about, you know, chief empathy officer, chief curiosity officer. Like when you have like to go on training to become empathetic or curious, it means there is something wrong about about this society. You know, like, I mean, like, you have to have like a self-proclaimed thought leader tell you that curiosity is important. I mean, it's what, I mean, I'm curious, always been, and so I don't need to force myself to be curious. If I meet someone who is potentially something interesting to say, I'm just really asking. I'm not trying, you know, to make them feel good through, because this is what's going on today. I'm sure, I think we had this conversation already, Sean, like when you go through LinkedIn, my God, it's getting like so annoying. Like this self-proclaimed thought leaders on leader. First of all, let other people tell you whether you are a thought leader or not, right? It's like to say, I'm an intellectual. Are you seriously? No, like it should be, but, and they come out. I mean, I don't make names, right? But recently, one of the most famous thought leaders on leadership or whatever, like he posted like the summa of platitudes and banality, like something, if you believe it, you can do it. And he had 200,000 likes. But what the hell are you talking about? It's not true. The world is much more complex than that, you know? And then when you see people actually coming with interesting piece of content and actually try to make sense of the complexity, yeah, well, they have like 4 or 5 likes, because obviously for me, if you want, like the beginning of the decline of our civilization, in when they started put reading time at the end of an article, sorry, or the beginning of an article.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm sorry. Like if you go through some, it's like someone recently asked me, you know, a friend through WhatsApp, it was like a few months ago, he said, what do you think, can you describe me as a former journalist, like, what do you think about the way the European press is covering the war in Ukraine? Yep. And I respond, no, I cannot. Like, first of all, I should start with some question. What do you mean by the European press?
Yeah.
The European media, right? Are we talking about, you know, The Sun? Are we talking about Le Monde? Are we talking, like, I mean, no, like already that. No, but Justin, I cannot give you one straightforward. It's too complex. And there are, unfortunately, I know, Sean, there are ways to simplify complexity, definitely. But sometimes you cannot put in a one line statement a situation that is too complex because you are lying, you know. And this is one of the problems I think about our societies today is that, you know, there was this, for me, one of my favorite quotes is by, no, let me get, I'm a blank. Yeah, it was Costantino Brancusi, who was a famous sculptor of the 20th century. And he said that simplicity, it's solved complexity, right? So it's the difference between simple and simplistic.
Yeah.
You get to simple by going through complexity and untangle it, right? It's just by doing that. Simplistic is what's being done by too many people today. It's like when you're on a political level, it's just like simplistic solution. No, man, no, that's the thing. And that's why smart people don't go on TV anymore, because you cannot have a conversation when everything needs to be either black or white. Unfortunately, the world is either like 50 shades of gray are different colors, depending, but it's much more complicated than that. And so that's why, for example, for me, I'm trying to use, I mean, I only use LinkedIn, and, you know, but like, I should get back to it. I've been a little bit lazy, but it's just so frustrating sometimes. It's so superficial. And also, I was lucky enough, at least in the more recently, to get to know very interesting people in the business world who are actually looking for that kind of approach towards complexity, because it's actually intellectually engaging, right?
Yeah,
for everyone, and I'd rather spend, you know, hours trying to, you know, to help these people find ideas or new approaches through this than being on LinkedIn and you know participating to this circus of platitudes and bromides, you know, that is becoming really, 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 really annoying. And I don't know what you think about it, but
I couldn't agree more. I love your point about
it's quite annoying.
Yeah, your point about the tsunami, or indeed the circus of platitudes, fantastic. Now, I'm sure, and I know exactly who you mean. I'm sure he'll be putting out a book about that very soon. Interesting, your point about sort of new ideas, new approaches, etc. Who do you look to? Are there any? We were talking previously to this about sort of either authors that spark your personal curiosity, social commentators, etc. So where do you tend to get to your inspiration from, should you say, certainly at the moment? Anyone really doing it for you?
I don't have one name, you know, that I follow, or I have a problem. I'm not able, recently, I haven't been able to really read and enjoy a good novel. Mm-hmm. And not because I'm lazy, because I'm reading too much nonfiction.
And
so at a certain point, you have to reboot your system. And so you at night, instead of reading a novel, you go on Netflix or whatever, which is good. But in the meantime, you know, I've been reading. And what's going on is that, you know, going back to the complexity thing, you start reading a book and you start underlining, and then you get ideas from the book about new books. And so it's a constant ordering new books and across discipline, obviously, because I'm a big defender of the idea of a new renaissance, you know, in these times of dark times, we need a new kind of renaissance. We are surrounded by, too many specialists who are not able to see the big picture. You know, one of my favorite words in the German language is, I don't know if you've ever heard it, is the Fach Idiot. So Fach is the discipline. Fach is the discipline, and Idiot is universal, right? Mm-hmm. Is there people who knows a lot about their specific topic, but they miss the big forest, right? And I think that this is also one of the reasons we have so many problems today, is because we lack new Renaissance men, people who are really able to think cross disciplines. And this is where you can find the innovators and the real change makers, right? Because now more than ever, and it's actually proven also by meta research on university papers, the big our most significant discoveries are not found within disciplines but across disciplines, right?
Yep.
So it's a constant. And so going back to your question, I have here in front of me the books that I'm reading, obviously at the same time, because I'm not able to start, finish, and then move to the next one. But the great Martin Wolf, Crisis of Democratic Capitalism.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, yeah.
Reading for beach holiday.
Yes, exactly.
which is, by the way, always read with pleasure. Also, his columns on Financial Times, because it's not just great, the depth and clarity of his analysis, but it's one of the few. He is a real thought leader, and he doesn't need to self-proclaim himself a thought leader. Who has no problem saying I was wrong, and that's what he said. Very for true, example, about you know, do you agree? And also, I don't know if you read the book, but I think one of the best part of it is at the beginning. Yeah, when he actually makes amend about being part of the neoliberal narrative and free market, enthusiast for many years, and then he said, part of it was good, but part of it was plainly wrong, and the world has changed, and we need to adopt that narrative to a new reality. So that's really that kind of intellectual honesty. This is the kind of public intellectual that I really like. And then I'm really reading a lot now about futures, and being now focused on developing my strategic foresight abilities. And I read. So the last book I read, I don't know if it's Nicholas Badminton.
Yeah, he's great.
Facing Our Futures was great. And then, I don't know, like another like good one that is actually Out of Our Minds by Felipe Fernandez Armesto is British despite the Spanish name. And it's a big, amazing, fascinating history about history actually of thinking, of thought, or how we came to think. You know, and when you go through that, you see, my God, but like, what we're really worried about machines becoming intelligence, we should be really worried about us becoming so stupid. You know, when you see the kind of big leaps that humanity could make thanks to, you know, people using their brain in new and different ways, and sometimes to see the mediocrity that you have, like, it's and then I think because you had asked me to prepare like ideas of what I'm reading before the interview, and then I am rereading the amazing Revolt of the Masses by the Spanish philosopher Ortega y Gasset, written in 1932. And I was checking, I mean, it could be written by a thought leader today. I penned this one for you, Sean, just to tell you. So civilization becomes more complex and difficult in proportion as it advances. The problem which it says before us today are of the most intricate. The number of people whose minds are equal to these problems becomes increasingly smaller. 1932, you can say the same today.
Yeah, right? 100%.
I try to find inspiration from different parts and trying, you know, to, again, quench my thirst for curiosity, try to make sense of this complexity. And so, for example, when today we are working like on strategic foresight, on key uncertainties for clients, it's a combination definitely of what is going to be with artificial intelligence and geopolitical developments. Obviously, it's tough to help clients think in these terms, but the more you get inspiration from different disciplines, thinkers, and you start at least having a better picture of what is going on, and also a better perspective, also historical perspective of what's happening. But there is no shortcut if you want to try to understand and to help people understand better. You need to read good old books, whether they are like in paper format or whatever. Like, there is also a lot of BS in terms of books that, you know, like you see them, especially in airports. You cannot have like an idea of what's going on distilled in 50 pages, you know, like, no. Complexity requires hard work and you know, like another, I was telling you about one of the first signs of civilizational decay about like the time reading, you know, of an article. But now it popped up in my mind, there is even something worse. You have now this, I don't know if you have seen like the commercials on the ads on Instagram, like these reading apps. Read 50 books in 1 month without reading them. No, man, no. Like, be the most interesting person in the room through an app. No, you will become an interesting person after years of readings, experiences, challenging your assumptions. This is incredible. Yeah. You know, like, it's the shortcut society. I feel privileged enough, like, to have met along the way many interesting people like yourself. Mm. And then you lose sight of the number of, and pardon my French, but the number of idiots also who live this earth. And sometimes it's just like, what are you talking about, man? Like, and because you're so lucky to be surrounded by smart and open-minded people, and that really makes me and sometimes really, 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 really annoyed. But there are very tough times that we are going through, but these are the ones that we got, right? I mean, we cannot go back in time, or And it's difficult enough now to at least being able to choose who you spend your time with in your private life. And I'd rather be alone than surrounded by people who refuse to think while having the opportunities to do that. What makes me really upset if people like whose parents like spend money to send them to universities and then they decide for laziness or whatever to just turn off their brains and approach the world with a very close-minded, stupid, and intolerant way. So that's for me what really makes me angry today. And but luckily there are like also very very nice and interesting people around.
Well, what a sort of fascinating viewpoint has to be said. And as we edge towards the end of the conversation, and obviously it's been so interesting talking with you, Diego. Sort of two thinkers really sort of spring to mind that I think really that obviously sort of link into yours. So obviously Wittgenstein talking about sort of social construction, which mustn't prevent us from trying to understand the world and make sense of it via, as he's put, sort of, you know, inquiry, evidence and rationality. And also your last point, I think, really links into sort of, you know, the mighty Baudrillard, who say that, you know, we live in a world where there's more and more information, but less and less meaning. When we think that information produces meaning, The opposite occurs. So all very good. So go on then. So in terms of, dare I say, the short-term future or futures for yourself. So what's coming up, Diego? What are you up to for the the foreseeable future?
Very short term is holiday, I hope.
Good.
I'm working on a few projects about futures thinking with some very interesting people, and I really want now to focus on that, because it's like really going through history in the making, right? How can we literally deal with, and this is becoming really my passion. So if you want, like, my short term goal is really to get much into that and really make that like the central part of my professional activity, because I think that it's really what we need, and it's, you know, like when you end up with a client who wants to think about the future in a strategic way, well, you know it better than me, it's actually about changing the present. Right.
Yeah.
It's so nice, like, to see it happens. Short term goals would be actually to have this kind of feeling more and more in the coming months and years. When recently, through a scenario planning exercise with a client, I actually had to stop the people who were like already thinking far ahead. Oh, but if this happened, we should make like this and this. We should change. So it unlocked something in the dynamic of these executive teams, you know, and when you see that kind of excitement, when you see people actually really having the aha moment.
Yep.
It's what I really would like to live more and more, because from that aha moment, regardless of what that aha moment will turn into in terms of concrete strategic options or whatever, seeing the faces of the people who had a aha moment is priceless, you know. And it would be nice to be able to have aha moment also on a political level. But I am afraid that in these times we have a lot of innovation on a scientific and like entrepreneurial way, but definitely not on the political level. So, but I wouldn't be able to do that, because, you know, as I said, black and white is not for me. So yeah, my goals would be to really make like the future more part of my life and personal and professional, right?
Yeah. And just so we're all clear about where people can track you down, so go on then. So where are you on social media, etc.?
Yeah, so while we talk about it, you can find me on LinkedIn, I think is the best way. And I will,
surrounded by a tsunami of attitude.
Exactly. And they will respond, because that's another thing. I don't know if it happens to you, Sean. Like, people who don't respond to messages is like a different way of ghosting. I find it's just plain rude. It's just plain rude. And more people actually thank me. Oh, thank you for like your rapid response. Well, that's should be normal, right? But it's not. I'm out of, like, I left Facebook years ago, and I'm so happy about it. No, and you can find me on LinkedIn. I have a website. It needs to be definitely remade. But yeah, that's the way to get to me. And then I'm always open, like, for what I really like. It's always like to have a very nice and interesting conversation about, you know, like, what are you facing? What are your challenges? And I think it's one of the most interesting part of any project. You know, when you're at the beginning and trying to understand in what way you could help. And sometimes you might also say, I'm not sure I'm the right person for you, right? This is also going back to the honesty part. And I think it's really every person, every situation is different. I don't believe in models, you know, and like a straight jacket, you know, like it's like in general frameworks. And again, going back to the curiosity, asking the right question and try then to work on that.
Yeah, very good. Well, I mean, Diego, it's been absolutely fantastic talking with you again. I thought it was such an interesting conversation that took us through all things cross-cultural, the issues around strategic foresight, curiosity, complexity theory, connecting the dots across cultural, business, and social issues, etc. So all I can say is Diego Gilardoni, who helps leaders navigate uncertainty by achieving clarity through a future-proofed vision. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Sean. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The New Abnormal. This series is brought to you in partnership with the Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, which helps clients become futures ready. Just so you know, the issues discussed in these podcasts also link to my speeches. Check out seanpeterc.com for more info. Please listen to previous conversations in the series with many other fascinating guests. But till next time, goodbye.